Hi, this is John DeLancey, and you are listening to the GeekCast Radio Network.
Hello, and welcome to episode 218 of the Cinema Geeks. I am one of your Cinema Geeks, Optimus Solo, and joining me today, as usual, is the Comic Concierge. Hello, Dan.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going well. We are back at it again for our 14th film in our Alfred Hitchcock series. It just keeps growing bigger and bigger than what we planned, but I think for good reason. So today we're here to talk about 1944's American survival film. So a little bit of a different genre than we've seen before. We're talking about Lifeboat today. So like I said, 1944 film from a story that Hitchcock commissioned from John Steinbeck. Stars Tallulah Bankhead, William Bendix, Walter Slezak, Mary Anderson, John Hodiak, Henry Hull, Heather Angel, Hume Cronin, and Canada Lee. The reason I named them all is because that is the entire cast. So I figured you might as well give them all equal attention there. They almost all get, almost all of them get the same amount of screen time, a few a little less. So this film is set entirely on a lifeboat launched from a freighter, torpedoed and sunk by a Nazi U-boat. So obviously, you had a little bit of experience with Lifeboat. It's one of the ones that you had seen previously. So I'm interested on what your memory was from Lifeboat, kind of your first instinct as far as if you liked it the first time you watched it, and did that change, improve, get worse, stay the same on this rewatch for you?
Yeah, because I remember when we were watching Rope, you know, I referenced this because, you know, that in itself, very different type of movie, but similar idea because it all kind of primarily takes place in one location. That, of course, also kind of done through one continuous shot for the most part. Where this, not so much, much more cuts and things like that. But again, one specific location, almost not necessarily in real time, but all taking place on a lifeboat with really not much escape outside of it. And I, like I mentioned previously, when I watched this about almost a decade ago, I really enjoyed it. And going back to it again, I enjoyed it just as much. I think, and going into this, I am a huge fan of, you know, movies that take place in one day, a war in location, 12 Angry Men, for example. But there are some of them that aren't great, that don't work. And I think the key is that you need one important thing being that of characters that are compelling. Something that they're striving towards, and this, of course, being survival, and this an idea of like a notion of where it can potentially go. You see a lot of types of storylines that slowly get developed, things that you know are going to come in play, and I think that is really woven. So it's always moving forward. There's always like a kind of direction it's going, and I think part of that is what makes it really compelling. And also, considering this time period, you know, considering it is during World War II. Or 1944. So when it was being made, you know, near the heights of World War II, it was, you know, you can understand just the paranoia that may have existed during the time. This is obviously not that much of an outlandish situation. You know, it's something that was happening to some certain extent. And I think also what brings it all together are the performances. These are all really well put together performances that work well off one another. They're very distinct characters, all different. They all come from different places. And I think there isn't even some social undertones this gets into. Maybe not super deep, but there's certainly things it mentions or it leads towards, especially just, you know, regarding even certain characters that we'll probably get to more in detail. But generally to say, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was really well put together. And I thought Hitchcock did a really good job of making that lifeboat feel like in itself, like you understood its location, where everything was, and kind of bringing you and putting you that in that situation where you understood the dread and just the unbearable situation that they were in.
Yeah, I am also a sucker for limited cast, limited setting films where it strips back a lot of the hoopla, I guess, or the stuff that, not saying that it's bad to have like a film that has a lot of other stuff in it, like that can be good too, but like for some reason when it gets stripped back into a more simplified setting and amount of cast, I typically like it for a number of different reasons. Number one, it tends to lead to a little bit more dialogue heavy films, and I'm a sucker for dialogue when it's intelligent and when it's intelligently written and when it kind of leads to more in-depth character development. So you get a limited number of characters, but you get to really start to feel for or get an understanding of how they think and what affects them and different things like that. So it can be the craziest of plots, or it can be even a film that might be more, I don't know, I don't want to say ridiculous, but maybe something that you would take less seriously. For some reason, it gets elevated with me when there's more of a limited cast most of the time. I mean, there has been times, obviously, where that does not work. But I even think of like recent ones that we're not talking about like Oscar-worthy films or anything like that, but things like 10 Cloverfield Lane, where it's just a few people in a bunker that they're trying to like figure out. It was very similar, I think, for Z for Zachariah, I think was similar in that respect. You mentioned 12 Angry Men as far as a classic one like that. And obviously, we've seen a number of them from Hitchcock. You mentioned Rope. Obviously, there would be a situation where I would say it wasn't done as well. But we did have Dial M for Murder, which is mainly in one room. We have Rear Window, which is mainly in, you know, I guess one room, even though you get to see out of the window into a lot of other things. So this is Hitchcock's done this a couple different times. And I would say at least out of, if we're talking about those four, three out of the four were pretty successful. And I think you touched on a couple different things that I think we should expand on as we get through. Obviously, the characters, I think that's one thing that makes that. If you only have a few characters, you really have to want to see more from them, get interested in what their plight is or what their story is. If you have characters you don't care about and there's only a few of them, then you're kind of stuck. So characters that are interesting are huge, I think, within that. And then I think another thing that you kind of mentioned on is what he does from a camera standpoint, which I feel like the camera or our viewpoint is as if we're the 10th person in the boat, or, you know, obviously there's different amount of people in the boats at different times, but it really does feel almost like we're sitting there with them and observing it from different angles and different standpoints. Like there might be one sequence where we're over here watching and then another one where we're at the other end of the boat watching. And I just felt like I was there, right? Like, I feel like I'm in this group, even though I'm like the silent man in the back, but I feel like I'm there listening to all these conversations and things of that nature. So I think he did a great job with doing that. The interesting thing here is that it's perhaps the smallest setting. These other ones, we got like apartment rooms or buildings, or, you know, some of these other places, like I mentioned, you know, you have a bunker or you have a small village that just doesn't have very many people in it anymore or something like that. But this one, we're literally in a lifeboat. And on top of that, out of the limited cast, there is 9 people in this boat at one point. I think there's at least 9 in there at one point. So it's like a small area. It's the smallest of the areas that we usually visit in a limited setting film, but then almost the most characters that you could possibly get in there as well, which I thought was interesting. And what I found fascinating in my watch of that is that it would have been easy for a few of those characters to have seemed less important or more of a afterthought or lost in the shuffle. And I didn't feel that with these. I felt like all of them, we knew who they were. We might not have had as many details of as some as we did with others, but they'd spend time in various moments of this film giving you information on all of these characters. So you get a little backstory for some of them. You get a little bit through conversation with some of them, and you get to learn a little bit more about all of them. And I felt like none of them were necessarily lost. Like, yes, there's going to be some that stand out more than others, but I didn't feel like any of them were wasted. And I think that's something that we've seen a few times with Hitchcock, is that even if it's more of a side character, even if it's not maybe the central character, he does find a way in some of his films, a lot of his films, to still give them their like moment in the limelight or whatever it is. We've seen that with some of the supporting, or even like, I want to say like even smaller than supporting roles, like even like the little just guest roles in some of his films, where he takes the time to make that person feel important and for you to almost want to know more about them. So I really appreciated that. I will say, and before I toss it back to you a little bit, that my one other initial reaction to this film was, this maybe, we're on our 14th film right now. Would you agree or disagree that this is the least Hitchcockian film that we've seen so far out of the 14?
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree, because he doesn't have that dramatic camera movement as much. It's very, if I didn't know going into this, like, who directed it, I don't think I would think, oh, this is directed by Alfred Hitchcock, because it's you don't really feel the director's hand as much as we've seen in the past. And also it's doesn't have, you know, he always loves those conversations about murder. We get a little bit of that, but it's very, I think, outside the norm from what we've gotten so far.
I think it's one that if you, like, with what we've done through these other 13 films, if you're doing that, you can see his footprint in stuff if you're analyzing it, like, on a deeper level. But I agree, like, if you just show this to someone and then say, if, you know, somebody that doesn't obviously have a good knowledge of cinema, but, like, if you said, like, watch this film and tell me who the director is, it's not going to be Hitchcock as much as all of the other films we've talked about. You know, I feel like the other ones, you'd be much quicker to name Hitchcock than you would on this one, which I'm not saying is a bad thing necessarily at all. But I think that if you dig into it, you do see some of it. Like, even though they're not talking about murder as, like, something that they're trying to get away with or that they're trying to put on somebody, there is still the talk of killing somebody and if they can justify that. So we do have that a little bit. I do think the way he handles the different characters and not letting anybody kind of be left out is something I've noticed a little bit more as we've watched that we haven't really necessarily highlighted as much, but I see that a little bit. Obviously, you know, I know it's jumping ahead because we usually do this at the end. There's not a lot to talk about anybody's mom except through, I guess, some backstories. There is one mom involved, I guess, but not in the same way that we've seen it before. There's nobody that's trying to get away with murder or prove his innocence necessarily. So some of those standpoints are missing, but I think the main part is what you talked about with the camera work. Is obviously it's different because we're on this boat, so I think that limits some of the fingerprints that he would have on some of the other stuff that we've seen. But I just found it interesting that, you know, 14 films in and I watched this one and I was like, man, that one I wouldn't have known it was a Hitchcock film if you didn't tell me. So I agree with you on that one. Going into some of these characters, I want to kind of highlight them all a little bit. So we have 9 characters. I guess you could call one of the main characters that we have is Tallulah Bankhead's Constance Connie Porter, who is a columnist and has camera and all this, which leads to some silly stuff, I guess, on this boat. But we're recording things and taking film of some stuff, at least at one point. It was interesting, too, that this is her first appearance in like 12 years in a film. So
yeah.
I don't know what caused that or whatever, but she hadn't been in a film for 12 years before this one. And then we get an injured individual, I want to say soldier. I'm not sure what his rank is or where, if they say that or not. We have a nurse. We have another sailor that I guess is just a general crewman. We have the wealthy industrialist, which is Ritt or Rittenhouse. We have a radio person and a steward. And then early on, we have the young British mother. And then we have the German captain. So how do you think they handled that set of characters? Which one stood out to you the most as like the ones you were most interested or entertained in? And how do you think the dynamic between these 9 individuals worked or did not work?
I think, you know, Tallulah Blackhead, who plays, you know, Connie Porter, is the one that's really driving most of this. And she's the first character we see, basically. And it's her almost sheer will. And she's almost a bit of comedic relief, but seeing her as this person of, like, you know, who she's kind of just focused on getting the story, and seeing her kind of change and develop, and you realize how bad things are getting when that facade begins to weaken a bit. And so I thought her performance and character clearly was what was driving it. But I also think one of my favorite characters, one of the best things about it was Gus Smith, by William Bendix, who is, like you mentioned, he's a person that's injured. There's just something charming about him, which is almost like instantly likable. It's just really good casting because he's a character that right away you just kind of, he has an aw shucks quality about him. We are just wanting to, you know, hope he makes it out okay. Mm-hmm. He loves his dancing. He clearly is really fond of this girl who may not be into him as much as he is, and he just wants to make sure he can keep dancing. And it's simple storytelling, but it makes sense. It's a quick way of getting you invested in his character. There's a bit of stakes there because you know he has an issue with his leg, so it's not just can he get better, but if he can't, like what that means for him, which makes that scene of when he, I guess, spoiling for a movie that is how old it is when he actually has to go through that scene of getting his leg amputated and everything he goes through. I thought like his arc was one of the more impactful throughout. So, and then of course, John Kovac, and like obviously his back and forth with Connie was also obviously a big highlight. And it was interesting because I was like, he was so good. I'm like, I'm surprised we didn't get more of him and all. Because I couldn't really think of what else he's done. But I guess unfortunately he passed away when he was rather young. But I thought he was quite good too. And I think that's one thing with this. It's also really good casting because I feel like the character, the actors, you kind of know who they are by the way they look. As weird as that might sound, but they're very like it's. The rough and tough guy with, he's unshaven and with the tattoos with Gus Smith, they all kind of fit that role pretty well. So I just thought overall, those were kind of the characters that stood out the most to me.
The crazy part about William Bendix, who plays Gus Smith, is like he is a last second replacement. Like, I guess this film was like somewhat bitten by some bad luck as far as the production goes. There was a lot of illnesses, a lot of injuries, a lot of different things that happened. So yeah, there was another actor that was supposed to play Gus, and apparently he got sick right before the shooting began, and they brought in William Bendix to replace him. So that's kind of crazy that he was able to pull that off with not much a prep time. I think the director of photography was replaced because of illness. They said Tallulah Bankhead came down with pneumonia twice. Another person, I can't remember, I think the other female actress got sick during the production, and then Hume Cronin suffered 2 cracked ribs, and they said he nearly drowned under some type of thing that was making waves and got saved by a lifeguard. It was not the easiest shooting, I guess, in the world, but I agree. I thought I loved William Bendix as Gus Smith. Like, if I had to tell you like which character was my favorite in the film, it probably would have been him. Just because, I don't know, like what you said, there was just something endearing about him. He was probably, if you were not in a boat, right? If we were just, I don't know, on a street or on the ship or something like that, and we were all standing on the deck, I would guess that he would have been the most physically imposing, the biggest, strongest guy on the boat. But now we're left with him in a lifeboat and he's injured. So it was like a really interesting thing that, like, if it's not for this injury, what kind of different part does he play in this? And it is nice to see kind of all of the backstory with him and this girl and all the kind of what he's finding important in this moment, like what is important to him in this situation. And even though he's not necessarily the quote unquote leader of the group, because there is some back and forth on who's going to be in charge, I guess, of this motley crew. And even though he's not, you can almost tell that they're all looking to him for like that approval when they're making a decision, or for like the final say or the final vote in the matter, because otherwise we have what you could expect when you have a bunch of, I mean, there's 2 females for the main part of the film and a bunch of guys, and you get what you expect, right? The testosterone is going and why are you the leader? What gives you the right to be in charge? And obviously John Kovac is the biggest example of that, right? Like, he is the meathead of the group. Like, he's the one that just wants to be in charge. Doesn't want anybody to tell him what to do. He's the quickest person to suggest killing somebody and things of that nature. Yeah. So you have that. And then you have, the person with money, you have the person that's more of a celebrity in Connie. Like, you can tell that she's had some like notoriety in her career. So she comes from a different background, similar to like the Rittenhouse guy who has some money. And then it's interesting too, like how the other guys in the crew, like who they're going to fall behind and who they're going to listen to. And I think that's where we get what is an element of Hitchcock, which is the tension, right? Which is the suspense. And in this situation, the suspense is we have one German individual on the boat with a bunch of Americans, and can they trust him? Can they survive as a group of human beings? How is that dynamic going to happen when we're talking about World War, and kind of how that goes back and forth between whether they'll listen to him or not listen to him, and kind of how that plays? How do you feel like the suspense and the tension was pulled off in this film, and how Hitchcock was able, or Steinbeck, I guess, was able to wrap that up in the implementation of this one, I guess, quote unquote, foreigner in the group?
I thought it did a good job of kind of playing with your emotions, expectations, because at first you're thinking, like, of course they have to let him live, because it would be morally wrong to kill him, you know, because he hasn't technically done anything wrong. But you also understand where they're coming from, because he's literally the guy that blew up the boat. But, you know, it gives you the ability of trying to be on his side and not want him to, you know, face this ultimate demise. But then those things where you're like, well, clearly he has a compass. Clearly he does these things where he takes that trust and he morphs it a bit, and it plays with your emotions, and you're like, well, I guess you shouldn't be trusting him. And I like that. It didn't let anyone off easy, but maybe he does have a point. It did a good job of, like, pushing in one way and going another throughout, even though you don't have a lot of room to work with. I thought it was good at kind of going back and forth. Again, like, you always kind of knew it was where it was headed. You were kind of waiting for it to happen, and I thought that developed really well, where you knew the compass was eventually coming into play, and when it eventually did, and what the outcome would be, like him with the water, like it. Eventually, it gave you too much of an easy answer by the end, and maybe if it was a little bit more, because once he, of course, lets Gus drown, it's like, okay, well now like there's no debate here. It's, you know, then that goes out, and maybe it would have been a bit more compelling if there was more of a gray area there. It becomes very black and white by the end. But throughout, you know, I thought it was really well kind of constructed.
I think they did a good job of giving him enough moments in the first half where he is right, or he is actually helping. Yeah. Or at least comes across as if, like, he is the person that might have the best knowledge to help them out, whether he's got ulterior motives or not. But they sprinkle enough breadcrumbs in the beginning that it's like, yes, we don't want to trust this guy, but he seems to be right in this situation, or he seems to have the answer in this situation. So I thought they did a good job of sprinkling that in at first. And we're not 100% sure, like, what, yes, the compass may be obvious, but we're not 100% sure, like, what it's actually, like, giving him an advantage and not advantage, or how it's playing into it. Like, it could have been him just, like, coming across as smarter than he was, you know, just because he's not telling him. But yeah, you're right. It does get very black and white with the water situation with Gus and all that. I think this other thing it does, which a lot of these survival type films try to do, and some do more successful than others, is really, regardless of the situation where it's, yes, it's World War setting, things of that nature all play into it. But I think when you strip all of that away, it comes down to usually a look at human nature and what humans will do and what they won't do when push comes to shove, whether that's a terrible picture or a terrible painting of what humans are in general and what kind of things they can do when they get desperate. But I think it does always dance around that when you have this type of a situation with a survival film of, like, what can we do? What can't we do? Do we want to survive if this is the cost, and, you know, and those types of things. So it is interesting kind of how it plays with that, and whether they're going to trust him or not. And then once it's evident that he is not necessarily on their side, how do they deal with that? Right. Like, how do they figure out what to do with that? Do they kill him? Do they not kill him? Like, and all of that jazz kind of goes into it. So found that interesting as well. And then not to, like, again, this is an 81-year-old film, so I'm not too worried about spoiling things, but also found it interesting that towards the end that they're almost, like, reset with the same situation, right? Like, they eventually, in what seems like a somewhat comical situation with them dodging and whatnot, this German boat that they become, you know, obviously right next to, and then the Americans are shooting and not hitting them, but all this happens. But they do bring on, obviously, another person onto the boat towards the end, and then we're kind of reset with that same situation. Like, it's not an American, and what do we do? So I thought some of those way that they kind of transitioned into that was interesting. What did you feel like the last like act of this film? How did it work or not work for you?
Like I said, I think the only issue I had was like when they kind of made the when they took what could have been a bit more complex and made it pretty black and white, but it didn't really, wasn't a huge detractor for me. And I was, and that's one thing I didn't remember, is like, how did this conclude? Like, what was the answer? And, you know, obviously this was coming at a time where it was challenging to do endings that weren't like happy endings. Mm-hmm. But I do think it's interesting, like how it, like you mentioned, with having that other German soldier pop back up. Although I don't know if the one element is like, I don't know if that necessarily works, because you also know that other ship is coming. So it's not like they're under, is it just a matter of piece of irony? Is it just the idea of like, oh, this is creating a new conflict? That I wasn't sure about, but I thought like it worked well. It's maybe a little bit too clean, and I guess, I don't know. It wasn't necessarily the highlight for me. You know, obviously you have the German ship coming up, and I honestly did not remember the British, or I think it was British, or maybe American ship that then responds. And that was a bit exciting, because you're like, oh, wow, they're in the crossfire. Are they, you know, mm-hmm. are they going to make it out? Because, you know, how they, to them, it's just another ship. Will they know it's an actual, you know, British ship or not? But, yeah, I liked it, like I said, but I don't think it was just that it worked well enough. And, you know, with these types of movies, it's hard to have an ending that feels earned, but at least I felt like it gave you a distinct conclusion overall.
What about the ambiguity of that last German seaman that's pulled aboard? Like, they don't necessarily show us what happens with him or not, 100%. Like, obviously, there's a gun that gets pulled, and it gets taken away by Joe Spencer, and, you know, he's confused. Are they going to kill him? Are they not? And this, that, and the other. And then they kind of end it without, I mean, I guess we can assume that they don't, and that, you know, the British or American ship rescues them all and deal with it from that. But I felt like it was interesting that they did leave it a little bit, not 100, because you talk about, like, this time of history, you know, that's usually a happy ending. They usually have to tie a bow on everything. And it seems like they were able at least to get away with a little bit of ambiguity here with it. Doesn't show you 100% one way or the other.
Yeah, I guess, like I said, my only thought is that it would have, I think, maybe hit a bit harder if you don't also have that other ship coming in or something like that. Or like when they call it out directly that, oh, here it comes, or it's going to be here. So when they kind of tell you that it's only going to be like, you know, not an hour or whatever, I forget the exact timeline. So that's why that
ambiguity doesn't compared to like them just too, like compared to them just like floating off, and now they have another another foreigner aboard that they have to decide what to do with. I get that. We didn't talk about the so there's three people that end up getting killed or dying from the original group that gets on the boat at one point. We have the Captain Willie, the German captain, who obviously gets killed. We have Gus Smith, and then we have the British mother and her child. Do you think that was an important part of the film? Do you think they could have done without that aspect, or did it at least give you an idea of the stakes that they're at when that happens early on?
I think it just showed, because, you know, speaking of at this time, seeing an actual death of a baby was that like, wow, like that, it I think it adds a level of realism, and just that those scenes were some of the toughest, I think, because, you know, it seeing this hysterical woman and kind of where she's coming from and her baby being like that was, I think, pretty impactful, because it sets the stage right away of just like the dire situation that they're in. And then, of course, like her not making it either. But I thought those are, we even talked about them. Yeah. So, but I thought those were pretty impactful in the sense of like, I so much so it's like I try to put it outside of my mind, because it was difficult to watch. So
I know my wife would not have enjoyed that part at all.
Yeah.
So this film did get some mixed reception, right? Like, there was a lot of criticism at the beginning from contemporary critics at that time who were angry for a number of different things. There was some disdain, I guess, by some critics that they said that they were portraying Germans in a positive light, which I don't know if they watched the film or not and in its entirety, because, like, he's clearly the bad guy.
He's capable, like, he, you know, he's capable and he knows his things, and he's, like, you know, he could say he's maybe a strong leader, or, like, he's able to outsmart people, but, like, morally, not so much, you know.
Right. And I think it got some more flack for Joe's depiction. I don't know if that was more contemporary or more modern takes on some of the racial aspects of how they portrayed that character. I know that got a little bit. So it had some, throughout time, some critiques that weren't necessarily 100% favorable. But then it did get some Academy love and some award love. I mean, Best Director, Hitchcock got nominated. Best Story was a nomination. Best Cinematography was a nomination. And then obviously, when you look at it now, all these years later, it has a pretty high, I don't have the exact number on Rotten Tomatoes, but it's got to be somewhat high. I know it's in the 90s somewhere. So where do you think that criticism, critique lands, and do you put much stock in it when it's something that was written by somebody in the 1940s anyways? And kind of, like, what was your take on that?
I'd be interested to see what the criticism for the Joe character, because at one point, like, I did really like the line where, you know, they're talking about voting and he's like, oh, do I get a vote too? And I wondered, like, would the people take offense to that? Or was it the fact that, like, you had this character and he seemed like, you know, there were some stereotypical elements, but I thought the approach to him was done well for the most part. And I really like that line about, like, do I get a vote too? And you see, there's a really good scene where I think it's the Lord's Prayer, I forget what they're doing, and everyone else forgets the words, but he's the one person that knows them. So I thought there were some hints, like some really kind of nice smaller moments, but then also, like, giving him the background where he's also a pickpocketer and stuff like that. I'm like, that seemed unnecessary. So it kind of went one way, then went the other. So I could understand the criticism there. The German one, beyond him, like, sure, he's capable and he's, you know, is able to outsmart people pretty easily, but he's also, you know, a commander of a U-boat. So you would think he would, and these guys and the people on this lifeboat, you know, they're kind of just grunts on the soldier level. So it doesn't seem too outlandish, but at the same time, I get it. You're in a world war, so maybe anything in a positive light. It isn't a super, like, patriotic, like, go America type of movie. And maybe that was rubbing people, because it doesn't seem like this is like, oh, we got to defeat the soldiers. And maybe it humanizes them a little bit because it shows that he is, like, you know, an actual human being, good and bad. So maybe that was a problem. It wasn't very, it didn't make him into a cartoonish villain, which, so maybe that's what drove people the wrong way. But so that I couldn't agree with, but I could see some of the criticisms with the Joe character, at least when they kind of went deeper into his backstory.
Right. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I guess it was just some, like, high sensitivity to any type of portrayal of Nazis in a capable way. I don't know. It said, the one quote was, let's see, the Nazis with some cutting here and there could turn lifeboat into a whiplash against the decadent democracies, and it is questionable whether such a picture with such a theme is judicious at this time. I don't know. Like, feel like in retrospect that doesn't hold up too well, but
I mean, I get it, because if you look at, like, the propaganda at the time, if you were you know, the Axis powers, it was pretty, like, the depictions were pretty, like, cartoonishly evil, so right. I guess this probably by comparison was like, oh my god, like,
maybe showed him as too much of a person. I don't know.
Yeah,
too much of a human.
Yeah.
So another question I had for you, like, we're in the middle of the ocean, we're on a lifeboat with only a few limited characters. How in the heck does Alfred Hitchcock pull off his cameo in this one? Did you see it?
Was it in the newspaper? I was trying to see, like, is that where? Okay, I thought it was. Yeah. I thought that was him, but I didn't know for sure.
So that's interesting. There's a newspaper that is on the lifeboat, and he has a picture in there, which is an interesting story, I guess, because it appears in another film as well. So apparently he is in a newspaper article with before and after photos and an advertisement for a fictional weight loss drug called Reduso which is shown in the newspaper on the boat. And apparently he got besieged by letters from people asking about it because it was somewhat inspired by his own weight loss, I guess. And he used the product again in Rope. So his profile and the Reduso name appear on a red neon sign in Rope. So he used the same like fake product two different times for his cameos, which I didn't know about that beforehand. So I guess that was interesting. So he found a way to get in there. You wouldn't think it would be possible, but there he is. So, all right. Other things that you thought of that we haven't had a chance to point out or final thoughts on Lifeboat, Dan?
Yeah, I will say like it. I saw that one thing they tried to do is that they always try to keep the lifeboat moving and like it was out to sea. And I think that was certainly the case. Like it, even though it's clearly like on a set or something like that, I thought for the time it does feel like, you know, this sense of loss because they're completely out there. And I think they did a good job of like incorporating even when it gets rainy and the weather pretty well with what's probably like a limited budget for the day. So I thought just the production of it overall, which was really important because I know shooting in water all time cannot be fun, but I thought it looked pretty good considering. So yeah, I really enjoyed this. I thought, like I said, the characters were well done and had a really strong group overall. And, you know, I think to me, this was a limited location movie done right.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. The other thing that usually is not on my radar, but I did find interesting and actually somewhat noticed during this film is the sound and the soundtrack/sound, which there is none besides the beginning and the end. I think it's the only time that music is involved. And I guess I don't know which person it was, but somebody in the production that was doing the music or maybe even somebody that was involved in the production mentioned to Hitchcock like that they needed more music in the main part of the film. And Hitchcock's response was, where would the orchestra be, you know, in the middle of the ocean? And then the guy responded, well, where would the cameras be and all this other stuff. So he's like, that doesn't really work because you're also doing all this other stuff. But I guess there's really no music for the most part because of the fact that they're kind of out in the middle of the water. Besides, they do a song, which is a complete sidetrack here. But for some reason, I never watched The Real World or Road Rules or anything like that. But I do have a guilty pleasure for the challenge shows that they've done from time to time where they have like the competition kind of like Survivor or one of those types of things. And they literally had one within the last year or two where in the final they had to do this like ridiculous thing where they were counting money overnight so they couldn't sleep, and they had to count like, we're talking about like thousands of pennies or something like that. And what they did is they gave them like a half hour to count, and then they made them go up on the boat. This whole challenge was done on a boat, which made me think of this as well. They had to go on the deck and they had to sing a song together for a half hour, the same song, the same lines over and over and over again, and then go back down and count. It was like, I don't know who signs up for this, but anyways, the song that they're singing on the top of the boat in this challenge is the song from this movie. And really? So they start singing it in this movie, and I was like, you've got to be kidding me, because I literally had just watched it like last month. And I was like, I didn't know that song was real, but apparently it was. So that's about the only music you get in here is their little song together, I guess, when they're trying to keep their sanity. So I'm with you. I think this is a limited location and set, cast, et cetera, done right. Hitchcock's doing more of those right than he has wrong, for sure. I really like this one. I wasn't sure what to expect, but it definitely was something that I enjoyed quite a bit, even if it didn't necessarily feel like the most Hitchcock film that we've watched, which is not a good or bad thing. It's just an observation. So we're going to keep going at least with one more film, if not a handful of some more films to finish our Hitchcock retrospective out. The next one that we're going to be covering is, we're going to jump ahead in the future a little bit because this was 1944 for Lifeboat. And then we have the likes of some films that we've already covered, like Notorious was 1946, Rope 1948, Strangers on a Train 1951, Dial M for Murder and Rear Window were 1954, and then we're going to catch up right after that the next year, 1955, which is the film To Catch a Thief. Dan, have you seen To Catch a Thief, or do you know anything about it?
I have not seen it, and I do not know anything about it. So
yeah, I don't know anything about it other than the two stars. So I know Cary Grant's in it, and I know Grace Kelly's in it, and that makes me extra interested to see how they do together in this one. So that'll be the next Hitchcock film we cover. We're going to have an episode probably in between there to give you a little bit of break from Hitchcock. We're going to do a mid-year kind of catch-up for 2025. We're going to highlight any films that Dan or myself have seen so far this year that we feel the need to mention, whether good or bad. And then we're going to check in with our box office predictions and see at the halfway mark how our predictions are looking. Dan, are you hopeful or are you scared?
I don't feel good because I know there's, I don't think I had Minecraft on my list at all. So I'm pretty sure that I did not do great. So
yeah, it's going to be interesting. I kind of tallied it up a little bit and I think we both missed on some. So that's for sure. Yeah. All right. How can people keep up with everything you do on social media, Dan?
I just searched Comic Concierge on all the different social media sites and you'll be able to find me there.
All right. And you can search me out at Optimus Solo or the show at the Cinema Geeks, or you can check out my YouTube channel with the Geek Showcase as well. Or obviously you can keep up with all things on the website, which is thegeekcastradio.com, as they do a variety of things on video games, comics, cartoons, movies, etc. So that does it for this episode. Tune in next time for another chance to listen to more of the Cinema Geeks.